2. A bar of morning sunlight slanted across the bed. The cool gold bathed his hands. Outside the window, swallows dipped and swooped, building their nests in the eaves above. He could not watch them long, his eyes blurred, dazzled by the light. Emmanuel was in the armchair with a book open on his knees, but presently engaged in trimming his fingernails with a pleasurable concentration on the act.
"How's Pernetta?"
Emmanuel looked up keenly, then returned to his trimming job as he answered, "Very well indeed. A grandnephew of hers came up from Solari last year. That's her brother Karel's daughter's son. Karel Kidre, he's called. Nice young fellow. Gives her a good deal of pleasure to have a relation to spoil. He's in our office. In fact, he's supposed to be looking after some of my more onerous recurrent duties while I'm here. Those damned property lines in Val Modrone. Nothing like a 3-generation-long boundary dispute to keep a lawyer cheerful. But I imagine young Karel's mostly out at Valtorsa, if the weather there's like this.
Count Orlant?
He's fine. Piera is the attraction.
Piera?
You haven't forgotten Piera.
She's married. Eisnar.
How did you know that story?
That's right, you knew about it before we did. Saw her in Eisnar, didn't you?
No, she broke the engagement. They were to be married at Christmas, and it was put off till spring, and then all at once it was off altogether. That must have been a little while after you were arrested. Never did understand the whys and wherefores. At any rate, she's still not married. Count Orlant lets her do exactly as she pleases, of course, always has. Lets her manage the property, in fact. I've handled several matters for her the last couple of years. She is a much better manager than her father, I have to admit. But I don't know what's got into these young women. Here's Laura wanting to do the same thing, as if Guida would let her, and she hasn't the head for it at all. What do they want to be stewards for? What's wrong with marriage and a family these days? Handsome women they are, too, both of them. Wasteful.
Emmanuel's voice was deliberate, serene, long pauses between sentences. Itale listened, watching the sunlight on the red cover of the eiderdown on the bed, a dark red, somewhat faded. The fine threads caught the light in infinitesimal streaks of silver. The worn satin was very soft under his fingers. Warmth, softness, sunlight, color. These absorbed him. He must relearn them, little by little. Emmanuel's presence, his voice, his hands, that was the buoy, the raft. It was Emmanuel's touch that had first brought him back from the endless, limitless wanderings of fever. A hand held out, literally drawing him back, holding him in life. And his voice now, talking easily, meandering among all the names of home. A week or so later, Luisa came up in the evening to sit with them. Itale was propped up a little so that he could watch the fire in the hearth. The lymphatic swellings that had followed the typhus fever were much reduced, and he was comfortable, able to enjoy warmth and rest. Emmanuel and Luisa talked a little. He did not pay attention to what they said. She turned to him.
"Itale, do you remember the trip from Rakova?"
He thought a while.
"No. We had to come round by Foranoi because of the floods. None of the ferries could cross."
"No, but when... the day I came out, it was bright."
"Yes, it was sunny, between storms, windy. I saw the sun."
"Did you never see the sun in prison?"
Emmanuel asked, without emphasis, but Itale did not answer. He never spoke of the 26 months in Saint-Lazare, and Emmanuel did not press him, saying to Luisa,
"It's best he puts it behind him, no doubt."
As he grew stronger, he did not talk much more. He asked very few questions, even of Emmanuel, none of Luisa. She left a copy of Novesma Verba on his table, but did not know whether he read it. When he was able to get up, his desire was simply to get outside, to be outside, sitting at first, later able to walk a little in the wild, half-ruined gardens. People of the estate stared at him, tall and unearthly thin still, with his stubble-covered head, a strange figure. The night before Enrique was to arrive, for he had faithfully answered her plea with a promise to spend part of his leave with her, coming straight, or as straight as possible, from Vienna, she said to Emmanuel,
"Mr. Sorda, I need your advice."
"Not on anything very important,"
Emmanuel said dryly, and she took the compliment and smiled. They did not like each other, and had come to respect each other's wit and willpower, and indeed take considerable pleasure in it.
"It is very important."
"Itale or estate law?"
"Itale."
"Good."
"Is he strong enough to hear bad news?"
"I don't know, Baroness. What is the matter?"
"You know that he was a friend of Estenskar, the poet. They were close friends. Estenskar is dead. He killed himself a month or two after Itale was arrested. He probably never knew about the arrest. He was under surveillance, too, we now know. His mail was stopped. They were trying to make a charge against him. After his death, his brother was arrested and held for a couple of months, and finally released without any charges. Itale stayed with them just before he went to Rakova. So far as I know, he was never told. He doesn't know that Estenskar is dead. Have you ever mentioned it? Has he said anything?"
"No,"
Emmanuel said with a shake of the head. He clasped his hands and looked down at them, grim.
"I'll tell him, if you like," he said. "I doubt he's entirely unprepared."
"No. Thank you for offering to take the burden, but you should not darken your last days with him. I knew Estenskar. I'll tell him after you're gone. If you think he is—"
"Oh, he's hard, Baroness," Emmanuel said, still speaking grimly. "He can take it. I think he can take almost anything now. What he cannot do is give. If you can spare him that, if you can shield him from having to make choices and decisions for a bit longer, let him be here away from people. You'll have done more for him than that horse-faced doctor did."
Taking his own advice, Emmanuel left that week without ever asking Itale what he intended to do when he left the Sovena. Itale tried to raise the subject himself the night before Emmanuel was to go.
"You're sure that Father is all right?"
"You read your mother's letter."
"You've both been sparing me."
"No, not really. I believe I told you almost exactly what Dr. Charkar told us. His heart is not strong, neither is it actually unsound. He is as active as he ever was, within sensible limits. After all, he is over 60.
"That is the problem,"
Itale said, and Emmanuel frowned.
"Listen, Itale, there is no need for you to decide anything yet, just because I'm off home. Stay here as long as you can. Find out where your course lies. Don't let yourself be forced into anything."
Itale looked at him and then looked away.
"Would I be welcome?"
he said, so indistinctly and speaking so much aside that Emmanuel did not at first understand him, and when he did, answered without thinking, shocked,
"Of course, don't be foolish,"
brushing aside the question, which only much later, when he was hours gone and well started on his way back home, returned suddenly into his mind so clearly now and so painfully that he all but cried out aloud,
"My God, Itale, how can you ask that? What have they done to you that you can ask that?"
Enrique Paludescar had arrived a few days earlier, in a wild rainstorm on the 1st of May, very much out of sorts. He had loyally come to his sister's call, but that did not prevent him from resenting her expectation that he would coop himself up in the dreary house in the godforsaken provinces with her and a convicted seditionist fresh from jail. She had no sense, and she refused to realize that she was imperiling his position, his career, by making him come here, and indeed by insisting upon keeping Sorda here, even while he, Enrique, was in Vienna or Krasnoy. He impressed this upon her pretty forcibly, and at length, but when Itale came into the room, he turned, stared, and then put out his hand. His heavy face had gone pale. He tried to say something, but could not. He shook Itale's hand and put his left hand timidly on his shoulder, then awkwardly pulled away.
I hear you've been ill, he said, stammering.
He never succeeded after that in looking Itale in the face or talking naturally with him. Fortunately, Itale spoke very little, and Enrique did not have to try to explain his guilt and revulsion to Luisa. He could not make it out. It was the government, the commonplace, decent men he worked with, whom Sorda had been trying to subvert. It was the same government, the same decent men, who had taken Sorda and done this to him. It was incredible, unreasonable. He could not solve the problem, and Itale, by embodying it, made him miserable.
"How do you like your work in Vienna?" Itale asked him once, conventionally enough, and Enrique gasped and groped.
"It's interesting and all that. I don't do anything significant, really. Open letters, you know, and all that."
"Harry," Luisa put in, drawling. "You mean you censor the mail?"
"No, no, no, nothing of that sort, for God's sake, Luisa. What do you think I am? No official letters, letters to the ambassador, dispatches, and that sort of thing."
He said nothing more to Luisa about sending Sorda away. He planned to leave himself, however, as soon as he could. Luisa did not need him anyhow. She had begun collecting acquaintances, as she always did. A crazy mixed lot, but she always mixed her lots. These were neighbors, some of them neighbors at a distance of 30 miles, but they thought nothing of riding clear across the province if a full table and a hot political discussion awaited them at Ride's End. Duke Matthias Sovenskar, heir to the Orsinian throne, lived on his enormous estate 20 miles to the north, and no one forgot his presence, though he had not left that estate for years. The province was thick with retired officers of the defunct National Army, old now but still bitter. Their club, the Friends of the Constitution, had lately been revived in emulation of the young liberals in the capital. They sounded out Luisa cautiously until they found who the man staying with her was. In Krasnoy, she was considered a woman who had liberal friends but whose influence lay in conservative circles. In the Sovenna, because Sorda was with her, they took her for a radical patriot. Enrique protested, accused her of hypocrisy and of meddling with things she didn't understand, was reminded that she had, despite her lack of understanding, meddled him into his diplomatic post, and left, defeated as always. Luisa had begun to enjoy herself again. Gray-headed ex-colonels fought Leipzig over in the echoing salon, while their sons, landowners of the rich Sovenna estates, toasted First Duke Matthias. "Sovenskar, the Constitution, the nation!" And then their hostess, Baron Agrico Larrave Gothescar. 6'2" and black-mustached, broad-chested, magnificent, drank to her and smashed his glass into the fireplace. She missed the weight of such men as Raskineskar or Johann Cornelius, whose benign manners concealed real political power, yet she liked these noisy, quarrelsome northerners. Their power was only personal, but it was immediate. She wanted to laugh whenever Larrave Gothescar smashed another wine glass, and yet she was stirred. Her eyes met his fiery gaze. "Baron, your flattery has cost me 3 pieces of my grandmother's crystal," she told him.
And he, furious as she expected,
"Flattery! You misjudge me, Baroness!"
and stalked off, frowning tremendously to sulk, until the nearby discussions turned the course of his passions and he threw himself into the fray, shouting,
"But Vienna will hear no voice, gentlemen, but the voice of blood and iron."
They were all, even Larrave Gothescar, very gentle with Itale. He took no part in their discussions and generally excused himself early from the company. There was no need to explain or excuse his silence and withdrawal, The reason was all too visible, though he had been gaining a little weight and color as spring turned to the clear, bright northern summer. He still spent all day outdoors if he could. He could walk and ride a little. He talked with people on the estate. There was no reason, Louisa thought, why he could not talk with these men, his equals in education, and like him in background and opinions. What kept him silent, then?
"There is a chance Larrave Gothescar might get the vacant seat for the Sovena. You could tell him so much he needs to know about the assembly, Tale. He is extraordinarily naive."
"I'm not the one to tell him."
"Why not? Who knows more about it than you? The mistakes you could save him from making..."
"But I don't know about it. I'm out of date. I didn't even know till recently that Amictia had been suppressed. I can't seem to take things in."
He looked at her for a moment, diffident.
"And Estenskar,"
he said very low, as if apologetic. It was 3 weeks since she had told him of Estenskar's death. He had taken the news quietly and spoken of it quietly, asked questions, and then let it drop. She was disturbed by his mentioning Estenskar now, inappropriately.
"I wish you would help Larrave Gothescar. He's very young, very naive, but not stupid. I should think he is exactly the kind of man young people want in the assembly."
"He is.
He reminds me sometimes of you, when you were fresh down from your mountains."
Itale smiled a little forcedly, and she realized that she had hurt him by the comparison. But everything hurt him, it seemed, and he was afraid of everything. He dodged away, evaded, withdrew. He would not commit himself, would not participate. The only person he had sought out for himself was the Lutheran pastor of the village, an amateur mathematician, an uncouth elderly misogynist. He and Itale would sit out in the garden with a book or two, the pastor explaining, Itale listening, a lesson in gibberish, calculus, binomials, God knows what. When Louisa's impatience expressed itself in mild sarcasm, Itale explained stiffly that he had tried to occupy his mind with mathematics before he was ill, and finding he knew very little, had wanted very much to learn more.
"I can do that now," he said.
She had to let him and his pastor be, but he could not sit forever in the garden pretending to be a schoolboy again, evading all the problems about which he had been so passionate, the cause for which he had suffered, avoiding her. There was a house full of guests. In the evening, when once again Itale escaped again as early as he could, she felt some resentment or humiliation, and said to Larrave Gothescar,
"If only I could interest him in all the things that meant so much to him."
The young baron, deaf to her self-pity and tolerating no criticism of the hero, frowned.
"We talk! We talk! Why should he listen? He has lived what we talk about!"
Louisa was pleased. Itale had used to scold her that way, but no longer. Larrave Gothescar was the first man in years to give her a moral rebuke.
"I'm afraid it was my disappointment speaking," she answered meekly. "I miss him when he hides himself away."
"Of course,"
said the young man, and brooded, sunk in an awful tangle of enthusiasm, admiration, and jealousy, exactly where Louisa wanted him. It was the trouble with him. For all his unpredictable pride, she could put him where she wanted him. There were only two men whom she had never been able to bend to her whim, though one had twice asked her in marriage, and would ask her again if he thought it any use, and the other had been her lover, George Hélescar and Itale. Hélescar had taught her all she had ever known of fidelity. Itale had given her, a few times, for a little while, fulfillment. He had freed her then, as she had freed him. Why was that not enough, to be free and set free, to unlock the doors? When her guests had left, and she must face again the long days of silence, a seeming intimacy that was increasing estrangement, she found herself angry with Itale, impatient.
It was time he pulled himself together.
"Why will you not talk to them?" she demanded. "They believe all you used to believe. Do you hold yourself above them?"
He looked at her with an incredulity that shamed her for a moment.
"What can I say to them?"
he asked in a diffident tone she disliked in him.
"Have you lost your faith in the power of words, then? Or in the Constitution and impartial law and all the rest of it? All you went to jail for? Has that become unimportant to you like everything else?"
"Like everything else?"
"You are indifferent to them, to me, to everything."
He had no answer.
"You won't even speak. How am I to know anything of you, or you of me, after this time?"
"What can I say?" he repeated, rigid, obdurate, and she realized with horror that he was holding nothing back from her, that he was, in fact, unable to speak. He was hard, Emmanuel Sorda had said, but it was the hardness of rock, without resilience, mere ultimate coherence like a rock that is itself until it is broken. She could break him. He had no defense. He could do no more than resist her, withstand her, who had freed him and was now his jailer. On St. John's Eve, the wide horizon of the night flared with scattered bonfires. Every village, every outlying farm had its fire. Bagpipes droned by the crackling, lurid stacks of heath and straw. The young men and women danced, the old men drank. The night was full of voices, noises, half-lit, running figures. Louisa stood with her maid in the zone between darkness and firelight and watched the girls of the village tuck up their skirts and leap across the coals, in the rite as old as the fields they worked, the leap across the fire from barrenness to fertility. The older women, watching, laughed and shouted obscene encouragement. Men were quarreling already over by the big fire, working up to the fight that always followed drinking. Louisa watched, repelled, excited, envious, contemptuous, until Agata, who found it all frightening, made her come away. When she was back at the house, she felt stifled indoors and went out again at once to walk in the garden, watching the distant glare and dying of the fires.
Louisa.
She stopped short. He stood not far from her, on a path by an overgrown hedge which made a mass of blackness in the cloudy moonlight. She could not see his face.
I didn't want to startle you.
You didn't, she said, though he had.
Who could be afraid on a night like this? Were you out to see the fires?
He came towards her and stopped again. He was bareheaded in the warm night. He stood there tall and patient, and again she saw the grotesque and pitiful figure of the warder's room. Why must he look like that? Why must he stand like that?
They were dancing at the bonfire in the village. It was exciting to see. The peasants here are pagans, underneath all their sour Lutheran twaddle. They're not civilized at all. May I talk to you a moment, Louisa? Nothing would please me more. I think I should leave soon.
I see.
Well, that would certainly prevent any further conversation.
She could not control her irritation, more than irritation, a blind anger with him.
You know that I am grateful, he said very low. For God's sake, Itale, it's not your gratitude I want. If you want to stay, stay. If you want to go, go. You're free. You don't seem to realize it. All I want is for you to realize it. To behave like it.
They walked on to the end of the path side by side. The moon, some nights past full, stood over the low black lands eastward. To the south, four fires reddened the smoky darkness.
Your wanting to go implies, I gather, that you've decided we are no longer to be lovers.
He stopped and faced her.
I have decided. Louisa.
His voice shook. He took a breath, and with painfully evident effort said,
It has been decided for us. Nothing is decided for me. I make my own choices. Can you choose to want to touch me? What do you mean?
She said, terrified.
He stood still, and she knew that he could say no more, and that it was the simplest thing in the world to prove him wrong. All she had to do was take his hand, touch his cheek, touch him, or let him touch her. She took a step back from him. "It isn't fair," she said in a whisper. "It isn't fair." After a while, he said, "I don't know very well what's fair any longer. I don't want to cause you pain, Louisa. I never wanted to, and never did much else. Why must it be so stupid?" She looked at herself in the dim light, her shawl and the heavy skirt and flaring sleeves of her dress, her hands. "Why am I like this? Why am I trapped in this? Why can't I be free, free of it? Why can't we do what we like?" "Oh, my dear," he said in shame and pain, and he held out his hands to her. "I wish I was dead," she said, and turned and walked away from him. In the morning, when they met, she was calm and polite. "Well, what shall we do, Itale?" she said. "Shall we effect a joint triumphal entry into the capital, or shall we go back one by one? How soon do you want to go?"
"I don't know."
"Are you well enough to ride, do you think?" He nodded.
"I think I must stay for Larave Gothescar's party. He invited Duke Matthias. I should love to see that old man. Do you want to stay for that? It's in 2 weeks. If not, I don't know why you shouldn't go when you choose. Take old Sheikh. I suppose he's the likeliest one of the old nags to last all the way to Krasnoy."
His gaze was on her, unhappy, the blue eyes.
"Then I'll follow in mid-July. Enrique goes back to Vienna, then. I may go with him. I've learned not to stay in Krasnoy in the summer. It's dead. Dead center of a defeated country. I hate defeat."
She looked at him as she spoke, and he looked down.
"When shall you go, then?"
"Tomorrow," he said.
"Very well."
"I haven't much to take," he said, getting up. "And all of it your gift. You know that, Louisa. The horse, the shirt, the life."
But she would accept no comfort, not from him. He left in the early morning. She bade him farewell in the house downstairs. He went out to the stables, she up to her room. She stood at the window and watched him ride out the gate and straight away down the straight road between the level fields. He looked back once, half turning in the saddle. She did not lift her hand.